Well, listeners, here we are, Mark and I, marooned in Sydney by the UK air traffic control cock-up.
G'day, listeners.
We've been planning an appearance on the podcast by Mark from the 42 to Doomsday podcast, and so we thought we'd take advantage of the Hoosian having all the doors and windows open after the flooding that occurred at the end of our last podcast to pop over to Australia to finalise the negotiations with Mark's agent. And we ended up being marooned here so we can get a flight back to Marmoset International.
So what are we going to do to pass the time this evening then?
Well, I have one idea. Let me take you to a place where membership's a smiling face.
Yeah.
Brush shoulders with the stars, where strangers take you by the hand and welcome you to a wonderland from beneath their Panamas.
Oh, I didn't know they had a TWAS convention in Sydney.
No, it's Club Tropicana.
Oh, yeah, but we haven't got any money, Doc. How are we going to pay for anything?
Don't worry, the drinks are free.
Really? Oh, all right. It's very busy. I mean, I can see fun over there. There's plenty of sunshine up there, but is there enough to go round?
Fun and sunshine? There's enough for everyone.
Well, all that's missing is the sea.
Oh, don't worry, we can suntan.
Oh, okay. Oh, here we are.
Oh, what an interesting place.
Well, they do food.
What a posh Club Tropicana. Here comes the maitre d'. We better start recording this podcast, hadn't we?
Oh, yeah.
Welcome to Club Tropicana. Oh, how delightful to see gentlemen from the old country. May I show you to a table?
Do you serve humans here?
No, sir. Only Australians.
Do you know the cuisine of this country?
Of course I do. I've eaten shrimp off Mark's Barbie, haven't I?
Barbie? I do hope you're not going to fill this podcast with outdated Australian stereotypes, Doc.
I do wish you'd have some faith in me, Mark. I'm not going to go out of my way, am I, to offend our hosts by buying into cheap and outdated stereotypes about Australia? 42 to Doomsday Boys are our friends. And not just our friends, they're our friends ever true.
Will you leave that tape recorder alone, please, Doc?
All right, let's start recording the podcast then, shall we?
This time, can you try not to give away which story you're going to be doing right at the start, please?
You're a killjoy, Mark. Oh, go on, then. Happy day, faithless sisters, and welcome to episode 185 of the Diddly Dum podcast, the fourth best Doctor Who podcast out there. I'm Doc O the Diddly Dum.
And I'm Mark O the Diddly Dum.
And I'm sure the listeners are thinking, oh, no clues there yet. So, Mark, apart from flying to Australia and getting stuck here, has anything been happening in your life?
No. I can't think of anything that might possibly be of interest. No.
No, there's not much been going on. I've just had another birthday this week, so I'm not I'm not in the best of moods.
Oh.
There's lots of stuff on iPlayer that the BBC are repeating at the moment. For reasons I don't know, because it's an anniversary, the BBC have re-putting I, Claudius from the 70s on iPlayer. I actually saw someone on Twitter saying, it's very stagey, isn't it? The acting's much better today.
Oh, no.
You know my reputation on Twitter, Mark. I always just sit down, count slowly to 10, and then calm down so I don't reply anything at all.
You just let things go, don't you?
No. Ever since you finally made the point by getting messages from you and Hayden saying,
please stop.
If you're going to be the one that spends most time on the diddly dumb Twitter account, will you please stop being political? They have also, I think it's the 50th anniversary of The Ascent of Man.
Yes.
Which I've been rewatching. The understanding can hurt. I'm not really a science guy. But it really is an extraordinary affirmation of both of public service broadcasting in general and the BBC in particular. I did throw a bit of a strop at one point, because when Jack Abramovsky's talking about, what's it called? I must know this. There's a street in Little Manchester named after him. It was talking about John Dalton, his discoveries about atomic weights. He kept making cracks about the climate in Manchester.
After the fire, the sulphur, the burning mercury, it was inevitable that the climax of the story should take place in the chill damp of Manchester. Here, between 1803 and 1808, a Quaker schoolmaster called John Dalton turned the vague knowledge of chemical combination, brilliantly illuminated as it had been by Lavoisier, suddenly into the precise modern conception of atomic theory. For 57 years, he walked out of Manchester every day, measured the rainfall, the temperature, a singularly monotonous enterprise in this climate. Of all that mass of data, nothing whatever came. But of the one searching, almost childlike question about the weights that enter the construction of these simple molecules, out of that came modern atomic theory. That's the essence of science. Ask an impertinent question, and you're on the way to the pertinent answer.
Right, no, very brilliant. And then rewatched the, around about that time, I think he was interviewed on Parkinson, and it's this weird thing where you say, I'm sure chat show guests on average aren't nearly as ferociously intelligent as this these days. Not the last time I watched Graham Norton, anyway.
Oh, of course, Parky's passed, hasn't he? Very sad.
Sorry, the late Michael Parkinson.
Also, there's going to be another 60th anniversary music prom, isn't there?
Oh, is there?
Yeah, tickets are free. I don't know if there'll be, if it'll still be open for applications after this. Tickets are free if you go online at the BBC and look for the Doctor Who 60th anniversary prom.
Is that next year?
No, it's 28th of September, so it's a bit soon. It's in London, and I will not be able to go, unfortunately. Oh, no, it's not. It's in Cardiff. Sorry. It's in Cardiff, which is a city which some listeners may remember as my old hometown.
Why have it in Cardiff? Who lives in Wales? I mean, the Welsh, obviously, but more importantly, not me. Music from across six decades will be celebrated as part of Doctor Who's 60th anniversary later this year, with a special concert in Wales to be broadcast on BBC Radio 2. All those who can listen. Doctor Who at 60, a musical celebration, will feature music by Dudley Simpson, Paddy Kingston, Murray Gold, never heard of any of these people, and Sega Naganola, not to mention Ron Grainer's Doctor Who theme, as originally brought to life by Delia Derbyshire. That's very even-handed, isn't it? Making sure you mention both of them.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
The concert will take place at the BBC Hoddinott Hall in the Wales Millennium Centre, Cardiff, where tracks will be played by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales and blah, 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 blah. Age limits 18 plus. Oh, we won't be able to go anyway, Mark. Tickets will be allocated by random draw.
Yeah.
You can register at any time until 10 p.m. on Thursday the 7th of September. You can apply for a maximum of two tickets.
It's by the time this comes out that it'll be closed, won't it?
Oh, I see. It's date. It's on Thursday the 28th of September, starting at 7:30, doors open at 6:30, running time 2.5 hours. Right, well, we'll links in the show notes, as ever, listeners.
Which you can find at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com.
What else has been going on? It had a very rare piece of correspondence from a listener.
What?
following our last episode from friend of the show, Johnny Dab. Wow, you read out my Amy's crack post. Crazy. Interesting review of Love and Monsters. Interesting. Oh. Damning with faint praise. For me, that one is a 5 out of 10. I don't hate it, but I'm not that keen on it either. Recently, my youngest daughter, who was 14 at the time, and I watched all of the David Tennant stories. We started on season 3, then 4, and finished with 2. Love and Monsters made for some very uncomfortable viewing. The flashing knickers joke was a bit cringy, and her jaw dropped to the floor, although she was 14, where Jackie splashed wine on Elton, and she expressed the view that Elton should get the out of her. I don't think she says that, does she?
That's terrible language for a 14-year-old.
As for the ending, with Elton's suggestion that he could still have a love life with paving slab Ursula, he may have been referring to kissing, but I reckon everyone's mind goes to a smutty place. And my poor daughter was shocked, in a vaguely amused kind of way. I had warned her that the ending was bad, but I don't think she was expecting that. I liked the chasing of the monster at the beginning, all the Linda stuff, and the Absorbolov reminded me of Funnest Abogna. Anyway, thanks for reading my post out. It was a great episode of Diddly Dum to listen to. Ian made a great guest, even though he's a rubbish plumber. Many thanks, Johnny D. Well said. Well said. Other than that, I think that's that.
Are you ready to order now, gentlemen?
Oh, yes, please.
Yes, we'll have the Kookaburra in brandy sauce, please, with a stuffing of black pudding made of live pig's blood, herbs and pepper. And please make sure that the breasts of the birds are slit and studded with truffles.
Mmm.
And then we'll follow that with the barramundi with oysters and artichoke hearts, please.
And a family paella as well, please.
I'm sorry, those are off the menu today.
Oh, right. Oh, in that case, we'll just have the Vegemite on toast, please.
Mmm.
Thank you. Right, well, unless you've guessed, faithless listeners, Mark and I were puzzling over what story we could review, being stuck in Australia, not having any DVDs to hand.
And then we thought, why don't we review the in-flight movie that we'll just, we thought, well, that's probably going to be, what, Barbie? Oppenheimer? But it wasn't, was it?
No, by an extraordinary coincidence. And thank goodness it was a UK to Australia flight, because it was a 3x45-minute episode. The Two Doctors.
Oh, what a treat.
Written by Robert Holmes, directed by Peter Moffat. A story from the Sixth Doctor era, probably most famous for being a multi-doctor story with the Second Doctor, Patrick Troughton, and Fraser Hines guesting. JNT seemed right from the start very keen, didn't he, to try to boost links with the USA, possibly because he was hoping to make more money from the BBC. I suspect more likely because he loved the opportunity to go over and do American fan conventions, which have always been much bigger than they were in the UK.
Yeah, pick up a big carrier bag of money. And
and then he became keen to explore actually locating a story in the USA, planning that Lionheart, which I think was the BBC's distributor in North America, would be willing to invest. And I think in 1981, he made a trip to the Mardi Gras in New Orleans and decided to set a story there. So this ended up with a narrative called Way Down Yonder. I think there's a song that's Way Down Yonder in New Orleans or something.
Mm-hmm.
But then the co-producers pulled out with their funding. And apparently at the same time, unsuccessful inquiries were made about shooting at the Walt Disney World theme park in Florida.
That's hopeful.
Which made me think, I wonder how that would compare to the holiday park in Delta and the Bannerman. I suspect with JNT running the show, it might have been not much difference at all. And they got Bob Holmes to write it. And although apparently Bob Holmes was reluctant to revive the Santarans, he had felt that in the Santaran experiment and Invasion of Time, they hadn't been very well used, and he saw this as, perhaps ironically, as an opportunity to reassert his original vision for the Sun Sirens. Well, how successful he was in that, we'll get on to.
Yes.
Initial thoughts, Mark?
Well, can I start off with a confession?
Only on the understanding that I have no power to give you absolution.
No, that's quite all right. I've actually never seen this all the way through before. I missed the first two episodes on broadcast because I wasn't really enjoying the Colin Baker era. I wasn't particularly interested in it at that point. I remember catching some of episode three and just thinking, well, I've no idea what the hell is going on. And then thinking, what are they doing with Patrick Troughton? Why has he got those ridiculous eyebrows? What the hell is... Why is the second Doctor behaving like that? I thought, oh, this is awful. Awful. And that was it. So years later, the DVD came out, and I sat down one night, and I decided the best way to get through it was to have a drink. And I sat down. It was the Sontaran box set, wasn't it? Yeah, that I got it from as well. I was watching episode one.
Is that Bread for War? Well, we're talking about the DVD, or the...
Yeah. Video. The DVD box set, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's called Bread for War, wasn't it? Warrior, Sontaran Experience, Invasion of Time, and...
The Two Doctors.
Two Doctors, which sounds very generous. This is the BBC. But I think they were largely motivated by the opportunity to remove one of the extras from the original DVD release.
Yeah.
Obviously, that was the photo montage that they were getting rid of.
So I sat down, I got quite drunk, and I didn't make it through the first episode. I've got no memory of anything beyond the first episode anyway. So episode two is a completely new country for me. I've never been there. So I was surprised and delighted when it turned up on the in-flight movie. Anyway, so I obviously didn't enjoy it much in the past. I didn't have any fond memories of it, but also I didn't really have a lot of expectation of whether or not I was going to actually like it. I think the opening's great, with Jamie and the Second Doctor in black and white, and their banter, that, you know, the exchanges between them. I think it's really well done, and it really feels like Patrick Troughton and Fraser Hines haven't been away, really, and it's quite lovely.
And the rapport between the two of them is there right from the start, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah. It's brilliant. I guess they would have kept in touch through various Doctor Who conventions over that time anyway. So it's not like they would have been strangers to each other, but to be able to just slip back into those characters. And they absolutely did as well, didn't they? From those opening lines. I know, I think on the commentary, I heard a bit of the commentary with Fraser Hines on it. And there's that bit at the start where apparently in the script it said, Jamie has to say, look at the size of that spaceship. And Jamie and Patrick decided to change it to, look at the size of that thing, Doctor, because it made them laugh.
Oh, yes, that is a big one, Jamie.
And it's just, it's classic Second Doctor and Jamie, really. And I think that whole, whenever they're talking with each other and dealing with each other, it's lovely. And like I say, they slip back into those characters really well. Even though Patrick looks visibly older and he's got his grey hair, I think I forget after a while that they are older. So I stop seeing the age and I'm just like, oh, yeah, it's these characters. I know them. That's who they are. And I think that's really nice. But then, for me, the first episode takes a real nosedive as soon as they step out of the TARDIS.
Mm.
Because suddenly you've gone from this lovely bit of nostalgia and you're thrown very brutally.
Into 1982, aren't you?
Yeah. Is it 1982?
Yeah.
You're thrown very brutally into 1982 and a J&T land is there in all its glory.
That's what I'm one word to you.
And then the Rob Holmes script, which has been fine up till now. Suddenly I just, as I'm watching the scenes, the next few scenes, you know, there's the conversations they have with Dastari and Chassini and stuff, and even Shocker. It's so dense and it doesn't feel like Robert Holmes's kind of script. There's very little humour in it. I think there's a lot of techno babble. It's very, very 1982 Doctor Who. And my brain, when I'm watching it, just seems to slide off it. It's like I can't get a purchase on it. And I'm like, I can't follow what's going on. I'm losing interest in what's going on. I mean, something like, even Patrick just can't make a line like, 0.4 on the Bocca scale sound remotely interesting. And it's just like, what?
Mm.
Our monitors have already detected ripples of up to 0.4 on the Bokker scale.
And I just started thinking, oh, this is going to be a real drag. I thought, what a shame. And then we go to Colin and Nicola, the Sixth Doctor and Perry, and that little fishing thing. And I didn't like that scene either. And I was sat there going, oh, God. Because I didn't like Colin's doctor in that scene. I found Perry irritating in that scene. I found the script was a bit kind of felt a bit hackneyed. I thought, oh, Christ.
I can imagine all our listeners sitting on the edge of their seats thinking, no, this is Mark. This will end with, and at this point, I realise this is one of the best stories I've ever seen. But I think we've still got to be waiting, Mark, aren't we?
Can I just point out also at this point, I mean, the costumes are so, so 80s, aren't they? I mean, Dastari in particular, I couldn't look more 80s. He kind of almost looks like an elderly 80s pop star.
Well, I looked at him and thought, Max Headroom.
Yes, he's got the hair for it, hasn't he? Although I did quite enjoy the 80s bit of Colin Baker with his plastic sun visor headband thing on. That, well, whilst he was fishing, that's very 80s, but that was kind of cool. Anyway, I just thought, oh, this is just getting to be a drag. And there's loads of bits in the plot, and I was thinking, well, obviously we know nothing happens to the Second Doctor, because otherwise the Sixth Doctor wouldn't be there. Mm. And also, why isn't the Sixth Doctor, you know, remembering all this stuff that the Second Doctor's done? Why is it all news to him that all the brightest brains in the galaxy have suddenly been wiped out? Surely that would have come up on some sort of Time Lord records, and he might have noticed it with his keen interest in scientists and the like. And so for him to be shocked that they'd all been wiped out on the space station seemed, well, it's just done. Come on. I was in this, none of the Robert Holmes kind of charm, none of his lyricism, none of his humour in these bits. And then, hold on, I'm just checking something, sorry.
Don't worry, once the edit's been done, it'll be seamless.
What, it'll fall apart? You can leave that bit in if you like.
I just think I was, all he's done me, that was quite good though.
Yeah, you have to find a way to leave that in. So when Colin Baker does get to the space station though, there's suddenly there's like a little, there's just a little nugget when Colin, and he reads this line beautifully as well, I think, when he says,
that is the smell of death, Perry. Ancient musk, heavy in the air. Fruit soft flesh peeling from white bones. The unholy, unburyable smell of Armageddon. Nothing quite so evocative as one's sense of smell, is there?
Colin's delivery of it was absolutely superb. But that was like an arrow that pierced my armour, that line, I think, and Colin's delivery of it. And I started to thaw appropriately just as they got to Spain.
As all our listeners sit back in their chairs, armchairs, and thinking, oh, thank goodness, Mark hasn't disappointed us. He is the eternal optimist after all.
Well, I have to say, quite often when I come back to a lot of these J&T era stories that I hated on broadcast with all my black teenage heart, I quite often find that when I come back to them now, in my later years, I find that there's plenty of stuff in there to enjoy, actually. Who did the music for this, sorry?
Peter Howell.
Oh, Peter Howell. Right, yeah. So it's I think the music on this is really good, and I love it when they go to Spain and ding 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 ding, Spanish guitar chimes in, and that's great. And because they've actually done a lot of outdoor location work, it suddenly looks really good. And everything suddenly picks up. Once they've come away from the space station, where Colin and Nicola are clambering around the set of some 80s music video.
Yeah. Thing is, when you see that Hacienda.
Yeah.
Now, you might think, oh, that was filmed in the 80s. By just by looking at the quality of the video.
Yeah.
But there's nothing like, when you're on the space station, you're thinking, that's a 1980s designer's idea of a spaceship, designed by a 1980s designer, and put together using 1980s materials available to the BBC. It just screams, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I don't mean that in an insulting kind of way.
No.
But it's in the sense that it would be impossible for them to avoid.
Hmm. I like the bit where the Sixth Doctor says, "Notice the floor," and I sat home going, "Yeah, it's not the bare studio floor for once. They've actually put stuff on it."
I thought you were going to say that. I was thinking, well, Doc will be reviewing this with me, so I'm sure he'll be noticing all the flaws.
No. But I just, I started warming to Colin as well. I think actually Colin's Doctor, once he started being all grumpy and horrible at the fishing thing, I think he's in the quarry. I think he's much better once they're on board the spaceship. And I quite like his interaction with Perry as well. Although there is a very funny couple of seconds where Colin's Doctor is trying to get the wire out of the... he's gone, "Oh, I know where there's a wire," and he goes over to this rubbish ornament.
Oh, yes,
on Dastari's desk, and starts prying a bit of wire off it. And then it cuts to Perry, who's like a full frame of her head in shot. And this has obviously been filmed separately. She's been told, "Yeah, okay, Nicola, can you just kind of look in wonder? Look like you're looking at something in wonder." Her look of wonder has just made me laugh a lot.
Well, I thought, and I don't know if this is a sign of listeners of perhaps the sort of books I read or the sorts of TV I watch, but when I automatically assumed that I need to get a wire from somewhere, I automatically assumed either he would suggest it to Perry, or Perry would imaginatively suggest it herself. "Oh, had the wire out of my bra." Now, having said that, I can't think of anywhere where I've seen that, but it recurs so often in... must it be it? I've seen that in. And then I don't know what I was doing. I was watching the DVD. I think someone might have texted me on my phone. I looked down. When I looked up again, I'd missed they're not taking the wire off the piece of art exhibit. Mm. And he was then using it to whatever he was using it for.
Yeah.
He didn't actually just take that out of her bra, did she? So I had to rewind to check. What? Oh, that's infuriating me now.
Well, I can tell you, Doc, because I was watching Perry's bra very closely and she didn't take the wire out of it.
Well, that's going to infuriate me now. I'm sure I'll eventually think of it. If I do, listeners, I shall let you know in a future podcast.
I have to say it as well, speaking of Perry's bra...
which Mark frequently does.
Yes, I do. This is definitely one of those things where there's a companion for the dads, isn't it?
Mm.
I did think in that bit where she's walking through the old Top of the Pops set with Colin Baker climbing round, and you can hear this in the background. I thought, well, that's a nod to all the sounds that the dads are making at home.
It was like the camera crew watching Perry.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's a bit unprofessional of them to keep the noise of the camera crew on the tape. Although it turns out that was the noise that Fraser Hines was making, which which coped by his reputation.
Fraser, who somehow seems to end up in a pair of dark blue overalls, which is bizarre.
Yeah, he looks like he's been cleaning chimneys, doesn't he? Or he's a car mechanic or something.
Yeah, exactly.
In that short time that he went, "Oh, the doctor's died, I'm going to have to get a job on the space station." Is there any explanation as to why he's dressed like that? This is another story where, again, speaking of Perry and one for the dads, etc. Poor old Perry's always being pursued by dirty old men, Jamie's a young man, I guess. All her stories, these blokes just obsessing over her. I mean, I can kind of understand it. Certainly she's one of the positives about the series when I was watching it on broadcast. But she's always been chased by and obsessed over by dirty old men, including Shockeye, who's who even goes so far as to... hold on, I'm gonna have to find this now. I said it to you earlier.
If you want evidence, listeners, of Perry always being chased by dirty old men, here's a text I received from Mark while he was rewatching this story.
Oh no.
"I'm afraid my notes are even more disorganized than usual because I've been distracted by Perry's top." Now, I'm afraid that obviously I've just realized that this is us saying, so I rewound the video. the DVD of this has just completely ruined our listeners' image that we were watching this as the in-flight movie on our flight to Australia. But I'm not sure any of our listeners are daft enough to believe any of the nonsense we come out with. So what were you searching for, sorry?
Oh, I was searching for that quote I used afterwards. Oh, what a fine fleshy beast. But I was going to say, in fact, the script even has a couple of nods and winks to the... When I say dad's at home, I definitely don't mean me. Honest.
That would be the dads in business class.
Yeah. But there's a bit where the sixth doctor says, look at this pretty thing. See how it swings. I was like, well, the dad's at home. We're all thinking about way ahead of you. And there's the bit where she's being chased. She's caught by Shockeye, who's kind of grunting and licking his lips. And he says, what a fine fleshy beast. But, yeah, so that's Perry. Marvellous. Marvellous, isn't it? Did you want to come in at all and say about anything?
So from the eternal optimist to the eternal pessimist of the podcast, I agree that when it started with the black and white, with the Doctor and Jamie and the TARDIS, it was interesting, and there was that great rapport between them. But unfortunately, as soon as they stepped out into the space station, their rapport disappeared, not because I'm saying, oh, suddenly they forgot how to act with each other. It's just that they had very little interaction, did they?
No.
Apart from the Doctor, Second Doctor saying bizarre things like, when Jamie says something in sort of Scottish dialect, the Doctor says, silence that mongrel tongue. Something, yeah, bloody hell. That's a bit OTT, isn't it? But I watched this, and fortunately, because we were in business class, the in-flight movies not only had these Doctor episodes, but they also had all the extras as well.
Astonishing.
I was watching...
Unfortunately, I nodded off when the extras were on.
And that's when I pinched Mark's peanuts.
I might have.
Perfect. Make sure that gets...
I had to move seats afterwards. That's abuse, Doc.
And they had... one of the first things was, you know how on the DVD extras, they would often not just do the making of this story, but they might do a big thing on the UNIT family.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not because it's particularly a huge UNIT story, but it happens to have someone on the unit, so we've got to get it in somehow. And they had a thing where you had people like Terence Dix and so talking about Bob Holmes. You know, Terence Dix, mm-hmm. He's a bit of a tall policeman with a pipe, you know. Hey, that puts Hayden's impersonation to shame, isn't it?
Oh.
Rob Sherman sitting at home thinking, damn, he's good.
I really don't think that's likely to happen.
Why on earth have they stuck a documentary about Bob Holmes on this podcast?
No, on this DVD, on this film.
On this in-flight movie. Oh, well, we hadn't started this. On this in-flight movie. That's when they realised, my God, this is a Robert Holmes story. And that's interesting, that, because I wonder, perhaps if I'd been paying attention when it comes up and says, you know, The Two Doctors, Part 1, by Robert Holmes. I'm usually just twiddling my thumbs since it actually starts, when that happens goes on. I might have thought, but I couldn't believe this is a Robert Holmes story. I think this is possibly, for me, maybe alongside the Crotons, which may show just how much the show used to rely on Pat when using his bomb.
Mm.
This could well be Bob Holmes' worst story. Strangely, I did have a glance at the... This is the only story that he's fully novelised, I think. And I had a glance at the first chapter of that, for a reason which I'll come on to later. And it was lovely. I think, I wish I had time to read all of this. Because it was very much, this really sounds like Bob Holmes.
Mm.
But I'm thinking, I was listening to lines like...
I've carried out 9 augmentations on Chassini. She's at mega genius level now.
Chassini is now at mega genius level.
Hmm.
And you might have thought, possibly Pip and Jane.
Yeah.
Simply Chris Chibnall. You don't think, that was a Bob Holmes line, a zinger of Bob Holmes line, do you? Colin's doctor, when he's dangling over those wires, and he explains how he survived by saying, I closed my respiratory passages.
Yeah.
Oh, that sounds very Pip and James, isn't it? As does.
But if I were dead then and here now, it means that I was at the very epicentre of the engulfing chaos.
No, sorry, that is not a Bob Holmes line.
No, it doesn't feel like it, does it?
Bob Holmes wasn't actually paying attention during English lessons at school. And I thought, because he originally wrote his story for the New Orleans location, and apparently, from what I read, it was full of jokes about the differences between the Brits and the Americans and use of British and American language. You know, he says at one point, the Sixth Doctor says, he's talking about these great people he's known. He's going through that list of business cards that he's got.
Yeah.
And he says, oh, Christopher Columbus. And he glances at Perry and says, he's got a lot to answer for. And I think that's a leftover from that. But when they told him, you got to rewrite it, putting it in Spain. Now, clearly, it wasn't just a case of going into, you know, for every instance of America, replace it with Spain. He'd had to change a lot of that dialogue. And I just wondered whether that's what maybe went wrong here. It just didn't seem a Bob Holmes story until he gets onto what I hadn't realised, actually, until I saw someone mentioning it, that this is, in the same way that he did his criminally offensive attacks on the tax system in The Sunmakers, sort of saying that he was a vegetarian, which I didn't realise, and that this is his attack on non-vegetarians.
Oh.
Which you could understand, couldn't you? When it gets to, which is in a way you might think of as, oh, this is the silly bit, you know, where Pat grows his ginger eyebrows.
Yeah.
And he becomes an androgyn. You know, he goes off arm in arm with Shockeye on a restaurant crawl. But that's when I thought, oh, suddenly this is very Bob Holmes.
Do you think it's not only has he attacked the tax system and its employees in Sunmakers, Doc, he's also, in a way, he's kind of attacking ginger people.
I know. Personally, I mean, he's clearly a very non-Christian man, Bob Holmes. My essential moral compass is based on, is it chapter 2 of the Book of Luke, where it says, and it came to pass in those days that I went out a decree from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be taxed. And that's the basis for how I live my life. How do we get into that?
I'm feeling very taxed now.
a vegetarian thing. And those getting onto this stuff were either he's very clearly making digs at, or it's not meant to be a pro-vegetarian polemic, and he's just getting into the story where people, we've got these greedy race of people, the androgyns. But he starts saying stuff like,
animals always scent danger. They have to be dragged to the abattoir.
I thought, oh, that's a gloriously Bob Holmes line. All his stuff says stuff like, he's trying to tenderise Jamie on the kitchen table. Excuse the expression.
It's very painful.
That's simply a nervous reflex. I've been butchering all my life. Primitive creatures don't feel pain in the way that we would.
Which, as well as being a sort of thing that makes you think, you can see what point he's making there,
yeah,
is a lovely thing when he gets onto the rat eating. It's possibly one of the most disgusting things I've seen in Doctor Who, even though it's clearly not a rat.
No, I mean, it's no more a rat than the one from Talons, is it?
Apparently it was a fake rat that had been stuffed full of damsons, so that when he bit into it, his lips would go purple. It's interesting, because this would be something I often say when people talk of the, inverted commas, racism in something like Talons of Wen Chiang. Oh, how awful that when John Bennett is given makeup to make his eyes look Chinese, and people now say, oh, how appalling, how appalling. I often think that, I think it's quite conceivable in 30 or 40 years that eating meat will be a thing of the past. And people look back on people of our generation thinking, God, they actually used to keep and farm animals for the purpose of eating their meat. Will seem horrifically immoral a couple of generations from now.
Hmm.
Because that's in a way, isn't it? Where now talk about talons now, you're thinking, are you trying to remember what things were like in the 70s?
Yeah.
Well, if you're doing it the other way around, where you're starting from us now and looking to what things might be like 50 years in the future, you can actually see, can't you, where eating meat isn't something that those of us who do think of as, I've got to do something terribly immoral today. It's, I mean, maybe it is a bad thing that we don't tend to think about that sort of thing. I'm sure some veggies and vegans do. But that was interesting.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me a little bit of the trans debate we have these days, which, do you remember, I can't remember the actress's name, who joined Coronation Street. We had the character of Hayley, who was a trans woman who, in character, and people were just happy to applaud it, weren't they? And at the time, whereas now I think it'd be studied and critiqued, and like, why isn't that actually a trans woman actor?
Hayley Cropper, played by Julie Hesman-Helsch.
Yes, Hayley Cropper. You know, these things move on quite quickly. And speaking of the whole trans thing, I was disappointed in Perry. And I think we're going to have to cancel her, actually. Because she at one point she says, she's clearly transphobic. She says, I do wish you'd stop switching personal pronouns.
Oh, I found that annoying. But, well, I found it annoying for other reasons. And I thought, oh, actually, that's quite, it could be quite dangerous today, couldn't it? By the way, this is why you need a northerner on the podcast, to be able to pronounce an actor's surname like Julie Hesman-Helsch. But getting back to, unfortunately, the stuff about the Doctor and Shockeye going off on the restaurant world crawl, and the great lines that he's inspired to write when it gets onto the whole, what's that album by the Smiths called?
Meat is Murder.
The whole Meat is Murder thing. Few and far between. So you've got something which looks like, oh, attempts to give Perry some agency without actually, you know, going to the trouble of having to do something. So you've got things like, you know, there's the point where she says to him in the cellar, ah, so that's how you control the TARDIS. Symbiosis.
Yeah, but she's a botanist, isn't she? So she'd have...
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure how she might think. I can understand how she'd fully understand the operation of symbiosis within the plant world.
Mm.
I'm not quite sure how that would logically lead her to think.
No.
Oh, so that's how you control the space-time machine. The Doctor's fishing, and he says, I think it was Rassilon who once said, there are a few ways in which, obviously our listeners are clearly thinking, gosh, hasn't Doug got a good memory? in which a Time Lord can be more innocently occupied than in catching fish. And she says, no, that was Dr. Johnson, and he was talking about money.
Hmm.
Other thing, I do wish you stop switching personal pronouns, which to me is that's on a par with Pastor Sodium Chloride in Thought of Doomsday. And it's almost, she's got a good knowledge of grammatical terms. Oh, isn't Perry clever? It might make me think, oh, Perry's clever. What's she doing hanging out with this guy who's been personally abusive to her all the time? And as I say, Jamie should have had more to do and say. I mean, he's a guest. Not just a guest, he's one of the greatest companions ever. And what's he do? Just runs around in a kilt all the time doing very little. Interesting that we should have a story starring Jacqueline Pierce. Because, what is tomorrow?
Maybe that's why they showed it on the... On the in-flight movie.
Oh, of course, yes.
Probably a Jacqueline Pierce fan. That makes sense. Tomorrow is the 5th anniversary of her passing.
I don't watch this and think, oh, you know, a shiver up my spine, it's Jacqueline Pierce, because I think essentially here she's playing a slightly duller version of Sutherland. But I did read in a little piece by a guy called Timothy Robbins in DWM 165, where they're talking to Jackie, and she said, oh, I love the scene where I got to lick the blood. Apparently, John Nathan Turner cast her as Ticini. After he heard her laughing in the BBC canteen one day, he thought, I've got to get to use that girl in Doctor Who. She said she enjoyed working with both Doctors. I've always been a fan of Collins since The Brothers. Good actor and very bright. Pat was older, and you do change with age, but he was kind and gentle.
Oh.
I feel that both Ticini and Sutherland were similar in that they were both strong women, but there were more aspects to Sutherland. That's tactful. So I found her more interesting.
Well, I mean, to be fair, Sutherland was, you know, played over four series, which, you know, Ticini's just got these, well, I say just these three episodes, but... crikey, I tell you what, if you watch them one after another, it's a long haul.
I'd be delighted to appear in Doctor Who again. Now, this is an interesting thing she finishes with. I felt more at home and welcome on Doctor Who than I ever did on Blake 7.
Oh.
Now, that's not something that you just throw in as a joke, is it? Because I remember when they were redoing Blake 7 on the UK Gold in the 90s, they would often start it with a little 10-minute interview with some of the cast.
Yeah.
Remembering it. I always got the impression that the main, in other words, the Liberator crew, possibly not people like Michael Keating, I think certainly Cara Thomas and whoever played Callie and Jenna.
Oh, that sounds really bad, saying that.
what was that? Talking down about Jackie Pierce as if, either because they resented that she was clearly the most popular character on the, maybe alongside Avon, on the show, or because they're being too method and they thought that because she was playing a fantastically evil character, therefore the actress must be evil herself. But I got the impression from it that they slightly resented either her or the character. So I thought that was interesting, the point they made.
Yeah, I think that's a bit harsh on the character of Servalamp, because she's not just... I mean, she can be quite evil. She clearly is evil at times, but they really humanise her character in a lot of the stories, don't they?
Yeah.
And show different facets to her.
Well, if you can imagine, personally, if you are Sally Nivette, or would you pull the curtain down on?
The one whose name I'm never quite sure how to pronounce.
Jan Chappell.
Yes.
If you're a lot of the time on your, I suppose it's a bit like in Secret Army, where you've got, you know, a set of scenes, you know, with the goodies are all together, and then a set of scenes where the baddies are all together. So you've got, you know, a set of scenes with the Liberator crew, set of scenes with all the Federation guys. And if you're Sally or Jan, having to compete with people like Avon and Blake for lines or just anything interesting to do or say, other than, you know, just smile while you're activating the teleport for the men. And you then see an actress like Jackie given a character like Servalamp, where clearly the writers are longing to write great lines and, you know,
round out her character and stuff.
Yeah, as his scenes for her. I can imagine how easily you could get pissed off about that. In fact, come to think of it, I think it probably was the two of them who seemed most resentful rather than any of the men. Whereas the men, the male actors probably thought, well, she's been given lines and good scenes. Of course, what's wrong? What's different about that? Probably ignoring what happens to the other women.
Yeah, I'm not sure how chuffed David Jackson would have been. Poor chap.
David was competing with Jenna and Callie for lines, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And failing.
Yeah. It's really sad that. It's funny you mentioned Secret Army, because I was thinking they kind of do a similar thing with the character of Kessler, don't they, in that they do with Servalamp.
Yes.
There's episodes of Secret Army where Kessler, who's pretty much a vile human being, mostly, they actually show you other sides of his life where he's just a normal man, and you kind of start feeling... Those episodes, you sort of have some kind of sympathy for him in a way.
I want you to start writing in the human side of the SS Gestapo.
Funny enough, that also reminds me what I have done recently. I've been watching a lot of films. I watched Curse of the Werewolf, which is set in Seville.
All right.
It's a Hammer film from 1961, starring Oliver Reed, because Polly, my daughter, is now watching lots of werewolf films. And if anyone wants to suggest any good werewolf films to us, do get in touch via the social media. Thank you. Because I think it seems like there's not a lot compared to, like, vampires and stuff, you know. Anyway, I've got distracted. But I also watched Cross of Iron by Sam Peckinpah, which is a Second World War film, which is shot entirely from the point of view of the Germans, particularly the German soldiers on the ground. And it's an absolutely brilliant anti-war film. I highly recommend it. Also, and going back to the topic, which was Jacqueline Pierce. Sorry for my diversion there. I still think she's great in this. Even, I think, operating at 60-70% of her full power, if you like.
Yeah. Imagine her sitting on a flight deck on the Liberator, spreading her arms and saying, 70% power!
Yeah. And everyone just sort of turns away in disgust.
That will mean so much to all our listeners who understand Blake 7.
Yeah, but I think even, you know, at that, she's still great. And she's still, you're right, it's a very Servalan-esque performance, I guess. Servalan light, isn't it?
Oh, talking of Secret Army, we received a message from a friend of the show, Dave Kitchen, who's currently touring Europe.
So he's not here in Australia?
It was so homesick, didn't we, Mark? Standing outside the restaurant Candide in the Grand Place.
Oh, marvellous.
In Brussels, which was really impressive.
Yeah.
He'd also been, while he was in the UK, I think, last week, to Port Mirren, which I think it made us think, let's get Dave on to do, until Hayden returns to us, to do a review of...
Mask of Mandragora.
And then he'd also been to the site of the Eye of Orion, which meant, does that mean we have to review Five Doctors as well?
And he went to one of the scenes of Dalek Invasion of Earth as well, so...
Oh, where did he go? Oh, yes, where the... Yes.
Under the bridge.
And under the bridge thing.
Like the Red Hot Chili Peppers. Anyway, more on that hopefully in the future.
Yes, hopefully. But I think that the Sontarans are a dead loss here. I mean, really, they could just have seen the Androgons, couldn't they? Pick them a bit more.
Oh, don't make them any bigger. They're big enough as they are.
Oh, no. They were a wonderful design as Lynx and Styre. It's almost... I was watching them. It was almost embarrassing to imagine you... You know that thing in Doctor Who sometimes? You're watching Doctor Who story and you're thinking, oh, my God. Can you imagine any newbies watching Doctor Who for the first time and how they would think? Oh, my God. What's this rubbish? Androgons were interesting. Androgons, I think, it's an anagram of Gourmand, isn't it?
Yes.
The show was apparently originally called, written by Bob Holmes, as the Kralon Inheritance. I think the Kralons were meant to be this rapaciously culinary race. And I suspect that someone said, oh, we've got a race called Krals in the Android Invasion, so it got changed to the Androgum Inheritance. And now, this was the reason why I started leafing through the novelisation. Because I was wondering, is he at any stage going to explain what all these extra things mean? Like, I'm Shokai O the Quancing Grig. I am Chassini O the Franzine Grig. Not to be confused, of course, with the friend of the show, Gary Russell, who, during his editorship of DWM, was known as Gary of the Fanzine Gig. I find that quite amusing.
Ouch!
But no, it doesn't explain it anywhere.
Yeah, those Sontarans, like you say, don't big them up anymore because that one's about 6'8" already. It completely wrecks the whole thing of them being like these stumpy little kind of guys. All right, they've got no necks, but their heads are like really tall, aren't they? Although they've kind of kept that with the current day Sontarans. Yeah. I think the heads are far more similar to these ones than they are the previous ones. They seem a lot taller to me. And when I look at the other little Sontaran, I do wonder if they tried to get David Banks, but he wasn't available. I don't know why they made them so tall. It really ruined it. I did think there were some lines which did hark back to the Time Warrior a little bit when Group Marshal Stike was talking to the Second Doctor in particular. And some of the dialogue there was very reminiscent of the Time Warrior, I thought.
Well, who thought that giving him a swagger stick would make him more militaristic? I'm not quite sure. I must say, I don't want to be unkind, and I've got nothing against Nicola, but I do find Perry annoying. One, because she has... I don't think there's any point during her tenure when she has agency in anything, is there? And the accent... She does actually American, is she?
No.
Clearly something that JNT thought, oh, this will attract American viewers. Which, I've always imagined that Americans watch Doctor Who because it's quirkily British, not because that, oh, I wish this could be more American.
Mm.
And when you see this constant quarrelling between her and the Sixth Doctor, you think, why on earth did they imagine that it would be a good idea to have Peter Capaldi's Doctor start by being quarrelsome and developing as he went on
Yeah, I would let Deep Breath have a pass on that, though, because obviously that's the first post-regeneration
story. Well, that's the regen story, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. And also, I do think some of the snarky dialogue between the two in that is genuinely funny. You can see Stephen Moffat's sitcom writing chops in it. I enjoy that. But
again, there are good bits. There. Again, the restaurant crawl is fantastic. It talks about shepherd's pie. And I want human meat, you fool. Oh, we haven't had Nouvelle Cuisine hasn't reached us yet. And then I was thinking, the restaurant bill has come to 81,600 pesetas. I thought, even a family paella is not going to come to that. So I searched out the exchange rate for 1982, and 81,600 pesetas would have come to £420. Because I'm not. Actually, just a couple of bottles of wine could have done that in 1982.
Good research.
Never understand why they do things like, you know, the whole wrestling in premature thing, when you know that you're just going to have to ignore that for everything that's come before and for everything that goes after, aren't you? Which essentially means that only Time Lords can time travel.
Yeah, but the Doctor said that because he knew that the Sontaran was listening, so it could be that he made it up anyway, couldn't it? You know, where he's talking to Jamie. Is that from when he's talking to Jamie?
Yeah, I know he says, I was making something. See, this word, you shouldn't come to the end of this not understanding that sort of thing, should you?
No.
But it's interesting that they've got a race like Dastari's people who is very rare. It's not, you know, the Time Lords for them are not just some, you know, legend from history, but they're just the local bigwigs from their area, aren't they? Who are big collars. They actually interact with them. What did you think of the stabbing of Oscar?
Oh, well, at this point, this is the first time we mentioned Oscar on here, isn't it?
Oh, that's true.
And I'd like to give big props to James Saxon, who played Oscar Botcherby, who's the actor who's sadly between roles. I thought he was wonderful. I adored his character from the very start. His delivery and the way he spoke and the way he delivered lines really, really reminded me of Vivian Stanshaw from Rawlinson's End and the Bonzo Dog Band. But I loved the character of Oscar, and I thought it was great, and it was ever so sad to see him die.
I don't remember where I've seen him before, and he's... do you remember Brass?
Yes, I remember Brass, yes.
So this is the way the world ends, not with a bang, but a whimper.
What a stupid remark.
I was quoting Father T.S. Eliot.
What does he know about it?
I suppose there'll be no room in your brave new world for poetry, Father. Or beauty.
Beauty is a thing I'd buy and sell for Brass.
Wasn't he one of Timothy West's sons?
Yeah.
Who looked like Sebastian in A Bright Age Revisited, carries a teddy around with him.
Yes, I believe he was, yes. Yeah. He's got some great lines as well. He got some good stuff. I thought Robert Holmes provided him with some good work as well.
Yeah.
I mean, like I say, maybe it's just the delivery, but things like Interpol, my dear, they have branches everywhere.
Yeah.
And when he's introducing the Doctor to his partner, he refers to her as a dark-eyed naiad.
Yeah. He's quite Henry Gordon Jr., isn't he? Imagining the Doctor's the police.
Yeah.
No, he was really good, but I thought that, I mean, I have read people say, people will be thinking, gosh, hasn't Doc researched this a lot since he stepped off the plane? But someone was saying, oh, yes, this is just stabbing Oscar. You know, it's just, we shouldn't be shocked by it. It's just, you know, Robert Holmes saying how callous people, meat-eaters can be. But I thought, and particularly as they all then leave the restaurant.
Yeah.
No more shame face or sorrowful, as if they just had to apologise for breaking a wine glass or something.
Yeah. Do you know, one day I would like to do, I often think about this, annoying deaths in Doctor Who as a subject, or pointless deaths, because there's quite a few.
Mark, I'm sorry, we're not doing 2 hours on how Adric shouldn't have died.
Oh, come on. No, well, I'm not going to mention the other examples that I have in my head, but yeah, there's a few.
Oh, I'm good at that, yeah. We might find out that Mark has had a secret hankering all his life for Katerina. Now, to the killing of Shockeye, I'm not quite sure about. I think we all are, quite shocked as he goes and kills him. But then on reflection, so I think I read someone saying, you're not shocked by the Doctor's attempts to kill Chancellor Goth in The Matrix, are you?
No.
You know, where they're chasing each other through that jungle or that marsh. But possibly that's because Shockeye's played a lot more for laughs, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Whereas Goth has played far more for, you know, he's absolutely determined to kill the Doctor. So I'm not sure about that. I thought one of the best things was the, as with the explosion in the Antarctica in Seeds of Doom. Doom?
Yeah. Yeah,
Death Comes Before Doom.
Mm-hmm.
The explosion of the ship was really well done.
Yeah.
I thought.
It's the best thing they did with the ship as well, because the other bits of it didn't look so great, did they? That thing where Oscar says to Anita, "Quick down!" And it's like, it's about half a mile up in the sky. Bless him.
Any thoughts on season 6B, the whole argument?
Well, it doesn't make any sense, does it? This doesn't seem to tie in with it at all, because...
Yeah.
Because of what they say about Victoria. At the start, they've dropped...
Yeah, you don't have to learn graphology.
So they've just dropped her off to... So it's... This is Second Doctor and Jamie during the time that Victoria's with them. I suppose you could argue that it is 6B and the Doctor and Jamie went back and got Victoria, you know, which is entirely possible, I suppose.
Yeah. So, effectively, they're saying, who should we go back and get, Zoe or Victoria? Oh, yes, Victoria was the least annoying of the two. So,
I reckon Jamie probably thought he had more of a chance with Victoria.
It's one of those things where I've always been able, as a fan, to just quite nonchalantly say to myself, oh, the writer just forgot.
Mm.
Or didn't think it through enough. And I don't mind that too much. Except when it comes to... The Children of Time, which I get furious about it.
The Timeless Children.
The Timeless Children, yeah. And so I thought the overseas location work was used to very good effect.
Mm.
I didn't realise that Colin, for 10 years, shared a flat with David Troughton.
Oh, really?
And was his best man at his wedding, so clearly he must have known Pat very well. Who have we got here? So, James Saxon said he was in Brass. Dastari, which apparently for no reason at all, was used as an anagram of Atardis.
Oh.
Played by Lawrence Payne, who also, apart from being the chairman who dies at the beginning of Leisure Hive, and gets replaced by Pangol's mother, also played Johnny Ringo in The Gunfighters, and in the world's best ever film, A Matter of Life and Death, he played one of the prosecuting counsels who are in the trial at the end, are standing around silently supporting Abraham Fowler.
Who?
Abraham Fowler! And Amy Delamann, who played the Doña Arana, the old woman who gets who owns the hacienda, in Fawlty Towers played Mrs. Johnson.
Right.
Who, you know where Basil Fawlty knocks on the door and... he's convinced that this younger guy has sneaked a woman into his room.
There is a woman in that room that Johnson smuggled in last night. Right? That's the woman I've been trying to get hold of. Right? Right? Stand up. Stand up and watch. Champagne?
What?
Another bottle of champagne, perhaps? I thought you said you rather enjoyed it when you were on the job.
Have you got a screw loose?
A screw? No, it's just that I thought that I'd rather form the impression that there was someone in the room there with you. A female person, perhaps a lady, you know, an opposite person of the contradictory gender, that sort of thing.
Mrs. Johnson is in here, yes.
Oh, of course. I should have guessed. Oh, yes, of course, the little woman, eh? The only thing is, I thought you told my wife that you were single.
I am.
I see. So who's this Mrs. Johnson, then? The late president's wife, or...?
She's my mother.
Your mother? Oh, I see. This bit of crumpets, your old mummy, is she? Oh, this is rich. Oh, Mother Johnson popped up for a quickie, did she? May I meet her?
Certainly.
Mother Johnson! Mother Johnson! Come out, wherever you are. How do you do? Are you enjoying your stay?
Yes, thank you.
Well, I'll get the champagne. This calls for a celebration.
That's her, apparently.
Oh, right.
By the way, I don't know if you have many cathedrals near you, Mark.
Well, I do have one, yeah.
I don't have any bells that go boing.
I was just going to say, you know that scene where Group Marshal Stike staggers out of the... he's got all this gunk over him. It reminds me of that time that you left that pub where we were eating in Marlborough and the sauce bottle exploded.
Are you telling me that before I sat down, when I wasn't looking, you took the ketchup bottle and pared the interface, but left a very thin membrane?
Somebody had.
Two Doctors was released on VHS in November 1993 and on DVD in September 2003. Obviously, this is in the UK. I think the DVD release was for the 40th anniversary, and it was meant to be the release representing Collins' era. The DVD was because they included in it the famous Jim will fix it sketch, A Fix with Sontarans.
Oh.
Fortunately, this is the one that they had available for us on the in-flight movie. I'm never entirely sure what to make of this, whether the idea that... it doesn't help that Gary Glitter's Another Rock and Roll Christmas is one of my favourite Christmas songs. Now, this idea that, he turns out to have been an appalling person. Let's pretend that none of the stuff is artistic, in heavily inverted commas, stuff that he did during his life exists anymore. So let's stop. So it says on the Wikipedia entry for the Two Doctors, the DVD was withdrawn from sale, but has since been re-released with the offending sketch removed.
Mm.
Now, unless Jimmy Savile was touching up that young Gareth lad on the sets of at a time.
Ooh.
It's just an offending sketch, is it? It's the, embarrassing sketch.
I mean, to be fair, it can be sort of triggering to some people to see a prolific predatory paedophile on their television. It's funny, actually, I think on the Blu-ray, they've reinstated a fix with Sontarans, haven't they? But they've pared it down so that there's no presence of...
No, I've not seen the Blu-ray. Did you read...
of Mr. Savile on it.
Did you re-watch A Fix with Sontarans in preparation for this?
No.
I did.
No, I fell asleep through that.
God, who's that? Who's that woman with the extravagantly long hair who's clearly playing the Doctor's companion? And I realized, oh, my God, it's Janet. She's clearly got rid of her Tegan haircut while this was being filmed. I tell you what did annoy me. Have you seen it?
No.
Never?
No, I haven't seen it ever.
You know those enormous guns that the Sontarans are carrying around?
They look like axes almost.
They give one of those to this kid who's written into Jim will fix it as a sort of present at the end.
Oh.
And I thought, when you compare that, I mean, I have seen your Kang crossbow.
Mm.
And what are the your Lacertian gun, Mark? Which are pieces of sort of badly put together wood. And I thought, if you'd seen what they gave that little kid, that's what you'd have found offending. Get rid of that sketch.
Well, size isn't everything, Doc.
And I must say, that kid, Gareth Jenkins, who wrote in saying, "Dear Jim," as he enters the TARDIS, it has to be the second least convincing walking acting I've ever seen in Doctor Who, but there we are.
Oh, you better not. You better not say what I think you're going to say. You leave my boy alone.
Any more thoughts?
There's one thing I should mention, which is earlier on, I mentioned how annoyed I was by the whole thing about why doesn't the Sixth Doctor know about this. It is rather neatly explained later on, so I shouldn't have been so furious at the beginning, thinking, what is this? Silly. The Sixth Doctor would surely know about all this.
Oh, what did they say?
Oh, because of the time experiments that were going on. That's what's happened.
Oh, right.
They did cause something. So, you know, it's a bit of a MacGuffin. Just to round off from a few little crumbs from my notes that I'd like to mention, there's the Chekhov's moth hunting kit, which I enjoyed. Speaking of which, that brings me back to the wonderful Oscar, and I also loved his delivery of the line.
Can't bear the sight of gory entrails. Well, except, of course, on the stage.
I don't know why, but that made me actually guffaw out loud. I think there's another bit as well. What's it? Oh, another line I really liked was, "Never more a butterfly."
Oh, remember that. Let's have a look.
Which sounds almost Shakespearean, though, but I presume it's not, otherwise you'd have recognised it, wouldn't you, Doc?
That's very flattering, thank you.
Oh, and I'd like to big up the greatest performance in the whole thing. Came surely from the blind Spanish lady who said, "You are English!" And I also enjoyed the Sixth Doctor saying to Jamie, you look all right once you've dressed up nice and you've had a bath. You should do it more often. And Jamie goes, "Oh, thank you." What?
Well, it says in the novelisation that he thinks that bathing twice a year in the burn is enough to keep the creepy crawlies off.
No. Another, I felt this is quite Holmesian line, and very typical of the Doctor, who seems to regularly, even Jodie Whittaker's Doctor does it, but they regularly insult Sontarans about their looks, which is... But when Patrick Troughton gets to say, the Sontaran says, "I don't understand," and Patrick Troughton says, "Good, a face like yours wasn't made for laughing." That's it, I think. Oh, and I own one of the cookbooks that... not the actual cookbook, but the same...
Oh, one of the ones you was looking at in the kitchen?
Yeah, I own one of Shockeye's cookbooks, which I was given by my mum many years ago. So.
Because it was a Shockeye cookbook, or just coincidentally?
Oh, it's just completely coincidentally. I don't know what English cookbooks are doing in the Spanish kitchen, but, you know.
Give me a number out of 10. 10 being woohoo, 1 being...
If you divide out of 10, I would give it 5.5.
Well, that's the sort of score I'd imagined it would get. Whenever I filled in polls, I've always marked it down really badly. And I feel a bit guilty about that now, because despite the bumpy start, I did really warm to the characters. I think when Oscar turned up, I thought, "Oh, this is great." And then I started enjoying it, because it's very comedy, isn't it? There's a lot of comedy in it for quite a dark story. Well, that's very Holmes, isn't it? You know, shoving a lot of jokes into something incredibly dark. But I warmed to Colin's Doctor. I thought that the script felt more and more like a Robert Holmes script as it went on. I'd say for the last 20-odd minutes, I think about halfway through the third episode, I was thinking, all right, this must be about to finish now, and there's like another 20 minutes to go.
Mm.
And I was like, oh, this is starting to drag, but that's the problem of watching 3 45-minute episodes back-to-back. But, yeah, I enjoyed it loads more than I expected, and I've got a newfound respect for it now, and I'm always delighted when that happens. So I think I'll give it a fun 7.
So, good Lord, look at this. What are you doing in Australia? It's the Sons of Skaro. Mark, on that dessert trolley, is that a heart rate monitor?
Oh, yeah.
Just pass it over, would you?
There you are.
Dalek Skaros, have you brought us some information on the correct way to behave when you're visiting Australia?
Emergency regulations. Please do not dump bodies into the river.
Dalek Ray, we have a waiter approaching the table with a bill.
It's a trap!
Oh, right. Oh, thank you.
Let's have a look at the bill. Oh, no. Doc, I thought you said the drinks were free. Look, they aren't. We've had so many. Oh, I haven't got enough money.
Look, I think the maitre d's attention has been distracted. Let's just slip out, shall we, quickly?
Oh, but no one will ever see my definitive Hamlet now. Oh, well. Excuse me, waiter. Please take care of my beautiful moths.
Oi! Come back here, you haven't paid, you pommy bastards!
Good night, sweet prince!
Struth!
Taxi! The airport, as quick as you can make it. Bye-bye, everyone.
Bye! Bye!
You have been listening to the Diddly Dum Podcast. Find us on our blog at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com, on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Facebook, and Mastodon at Diddly Dum, on Twitter at diddly_dum, or email us at diddlydumpodcast@yahoo.co.uk.
Diddly Dum, it is liquid podcasting. Stick it in your ear, old sunshine.